Get informed no matter where you are or what you're doing. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now and get news when you want it on your schedule.
Big tech dominating our headlines.
Another win for Donald Trump.
A key inflation report.
These are short audio reports, 5 minutes or less, that bring you the latest headlines with context 24 hours a day. Stay on top of the latest news from around the world. Get it on your smartphone. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen.
A border dispute between Thailand and Cambodia could boil over and into something much worse.
Both sides have their troops staring down at each other. Neither side can back down because to give up any land is politically disastrous.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. More about that typically bustling border area and a new oceanside resort in North Korea. Could foreign tourists one day mingle there with North Koreans?
I do not see that happening.
Also on the show today, they're only in season for a short time, and they're only perfectly ripe for even shorter, which may explain why everybody's crazy for mangoes, any kind.
People will like sweet mango, some will like sour mango, some will like hairy mango, some will like mango which is hairless.
All that and more today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for spending part of your Thursday with us.
Thailand has sealed off its border with Cambodia, delivering a sharp blow to the country's economy. Everything from goods to tourists are now stopped from crossing into Cambodia. This is the latest development in a dispute between the two countries that centered on a remote piece of borderland claimed by both Cambodia and Thailand. The World's Patrick Nguyen is following the story from the Thai capital, Bangkok. Patrick, this seems like a real escalation by Thailand. What does it mean for Cambodia?
It could be very painful to Cambodia. Thailand is the more powerful country. It's 3 times the size of Cambodia. The economy is 16 times bigger. And Cambodia relies on selling stuff to Thailand, vegetables, sugar, machinery, clothing. In a flash, that is just gone. I spoke to someone who's at the border today where all that trade takes place, a food writer and photographer named Austin Bush. And he told me what things were like when he went to visit a sprawling market that lines the border.
It's usually a really busy area, but today it's just absolutely dead. There's a handful of shops open. The border is closed, so there's not the usual queues to cross the border, and it just feels dead.
And so on top of that, Carolyn, it's actually worse than that. Thailand is not letting foreigners who come to Thailand travel to Cambodia. So people come to Thailand and they think, oh, let me tack on a day trip to Cambodia to see the Angkor Wat Temple, one of the wonders of Southeast Asia. That's blocked too. So this will really hurt the economy of Cambodia.
So this is rooted in a dispute over contested territory. How long has that dispute been going on, and why this escalation now, Patrick?
If you really want to go back to 1906 or 1907, when the border was poorly demarcated by France and the Kingdom of Siam. So it goes back really, really deep. The heart of this conflict today is that there are small pieces of land, like I said, on a poorly drawn border. Both sides claim them. It's not strategically important land. It's mostly jungle, but both sides have their troops staring down at each other. Neither side can back down because to give up any land is politically disastrous. So when Thailand's Prime Minister Prayuttchan Chan-o-wat gave a speech justifying this decision to close the border, she actually said something interesting and unexpected. So the Prime Minister is saying, we actually had to do this to make sure criminal groups in Cambodia don't get the supplies they need to operate. Bit out of left field. In Cambodia, this is true, across the Thai border, there are organized crime syndicates operating scam compounds, these underground call centers that contact people from Asia to Europe to America, trying to con them out of money. Yes, this is a real thing, but to become suddenly very concerned about this now during a land dispute is quite the coincidence.
So they're saying this is not about the land dispute at all, but instead about cutting off supplies to these scammers?
It seems that saying we're trying to hurt criminals sounds a lot better than we are trying to wound your entire country so you will see who's boss and back down. It provides a better off-ramp when they want to negotiate this to a more peaceful place.
Got it. Okay. So how has Cambodia reacted and responded so far?
both Thailand and Cambodia, if you're looking at how people, the public, are responding, things are getting pretty heated. There's this historical rivalry. It's not as intense as India-Pakistan, but it flares up every 10 years or so over these small pieces of land. Today, that beef plays out on the modern age on social media. So you'll see Thais saying, "We have fighter jets and you don't." And Cambodians saying, "Oh yeah, well, you stole most of your culture from us. We invented the sport that you call Muay Thai and your traditional style of dance," and so on. So that's what the hotheads on social media are saying to define the narrative. I think regular people, especially in Cambodia, want to see this resolved so they can get back to trading goods and feeding their kids. Most people are not full of this hatred.
Mm. So this border closure, it's a big deal. Is there a concern that it will escalate into something even worse?
There is. And very recently, tonight, Thailand's defense minister said that they should be prepared for just that. It's probably unlikely. It's not impossible, especially if you count small skirmishes as war. That's actually already happened. Last month, there was a 10-minute shootout that left a Cambodian soldier dead, and then both sides pulled back. I think there's a couple more steps on the escalation ladder before we get to a full-on war. Thailand's prime minister has already hinted that if this goes in a worse direction, she could cut off oil and gas to Cambodia, and that is about a third of Cambodia's energy. So that would be a crippling, perhaps existential blow. So the other fear is that with tempers running high, there's a misunderstanding on the border and another clash kicks off by accident. And so, yeah, things are pretty tense.
Patrick, switching gears for a second, while we've got you on the line, there are two headlines that caught our eye and we wanted to ask you about, both about drug trafficking in Southeast Asia, which is something you follow closely. First, officials in the UK say they've been seeing a lot more drug smuggling from Thailand, specifically suitcases full of marijuana over the last year or more. Do you know what is going on there?
Well, Thailand for the last 3 years has had this freewheeling legal atmosphere towards weed. There's more than 10,000 weed stores that have opened up legally. They're everywhere. I've got three shops right on my street.
Wow.
And cannabis is really cheap here. So there's financial incentives for a British traveler to load up on weed and take it back to London and resell it for a much, much higher price. It's actually shocking how many people do this. We're talking dozens of tons of weed per year are going on commercial flights from Bangkok to London. So yeah, the UK is very annoyed at Thailand for not reining this in. At the same time, there have been certain Thai politicians trying and failing to rein it in on this side. And finally, this pressure from the UK seems to have tipped the scales. So as of this week, everyone buying weed in Thailand is supposed to show a doctor's note. How do I put this? Laws on vice are not always perfectly enforced in Thailand. So let's see how obedient the zillions of weed stores are about demanding to see that prescription.
I hear a healthy dose of skepticism in that answer.
Yep.
And then finally, Patrick, Myanmar, we saw there today that $300 million worth of methamphetamine was burned there by the military government. That seems like a big amount, a big number. Is there anything new there?
Well, the military government of Myanmar likes to, every year, burn a lot of drugs because it's the UN's International Day Against Drug Abuse and Illicit Trafficking. So it's really a big show. Myanmar is probably the biggest source of methamphetamine in the world. Going back to the UN, they estimate that the meth economy in this part of the world centered in Myanmar is worth $30 to $60 billion.
Wow.
So $300 million, yeah, that sounds great and all, but it's really a drop in the bucket from what's hitting the streets.
The world's Southeast Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Carolyn.
North Korean beach resort, four words that you don't hear together a lot in that order, but the so-called Hermit Kingdom is trying to change its image and is opening a sprawling oceanfront complex in North Korea's Wonsan Kalma tourist zone. Gushing coverage there on North Korean state television of Kim Jong-un's ribbon-cutting ceremony and tour of the site this week. We wanted to learn more, so we reached out to Rachel Min-Young Lee. She's a senior fellow for the Stimson Center's Korea program. I asked her what clientele the resort is looking to attract.
We have seen
groups of Russian travelers going into North Korea. And in fact, North Korea opened its doors to Russian tourists in February 2024. And of course, the North Korea-Russia treaty that was signed by Kim and Putin in Pyongyang in 2024, one of the articles in the treaty talks about boosting the two countries' cooperation on, among other things, tourism. So I think we can expect to see North Korea maybe putting efforts into attracting Russian tourists first. And, you know, it's notable that the Russian ambassador to North Korea was there at the opening ceremony. You will note in the report on the opening ceremony that they will open on the 1st of July to domestic tourists first.
Right.
So they're going to take a phased approach. So, you know, after a little bit, they're going to open their doors to foreigners and they'll start with the Russians.
How many North Koreans could actually afford to go to a resort like this?
I would say the privileged class in Pyongyang and, you know, some of the major cities outside of Pyongyang, but that's just about it. But then, you know, on North Korean TV, you do see North Koreans going to the ski resort.
Mm.
So there is a little demand, but maybe not too much.
A small audience there in North Korea.
Yeah, a very limited, very small audience.
So one could imagine a Russian tourist going to this resort. Would they be able to mingle with those kind of well-heeled North Koreans?
I do not see that happening.
So kind of a segregated resort.
Segregated, yes.
Wow.
They will probably have sections, different sections, you know, cordoned off so that you have foreigners. And then on maybe the other side of the resort, you might have the North Korean people. And it seems big enough for them to do that.
Given the economic problems North Korea is facing, are you surprised a cash-strapped regime like North Korea is taking on this sort of project?
North Korea has had no issues undertaking major economic projects, big construction projects. There are several ongoing at the moment. You know, the various rural construction projects, the 20 by 10, which is building 20 factories across the country every year for the next 10 years. So these are big construction projects that Kim Jong-un likes to flaunt to be able to show the people that he's doing something for the economy. But in terms of how they can afford this, you know, this goes back to the question of how does North Korea, given its economic situation, afford anything, including missiles and, you know, nuclear weapons development. And North Korea has somehow always found ways to find money for whatever project Kim Jong-un wants to undertake. And hence, you see nowadays a lot of theft online being perpetrated by the North Koreans, though the cash flowing in from Russia as well. I mean, that's another thing that we need to think about these days.
Rachel, what else are Kim and North Korea doing to develop its tourist sector specifically?
Kim Jong-un, at the opening ceremony in his speech, he indicated that this was really just the start. He said at the Ninth Party Congress, they will present tasks on further developing the nation's tourism industry, including creating tourist districts across the country. Now, North Korea has done that before, so it's kind of deja vu. We don't know how successful this new endeavor is going to be because they've tried it before and they didn't quite work out. But we shall see, because maybe Russia's part of that picture. Again, they do talk about economic cooperation at various levels.
I'm scratching my head a little bit here because North Korea is known as the Hermit Kingdom for a reason, intentional isolation. Is Kim Jong-un worried about opening up the country to foreign influence, or is he kind of changing his tune on that?
No, he's always been concerned. And, you know, I do think that he remains concerned. And, you know, when they do build these districts, they'll make sure that there is really no mingling between the North Koreans and foreigners.
I've got to ask you, Rachel, is the Wonsan Kalma tourist resort on your bucket list, either for fun or curiosity?
Well, as a South Korean national, I don't think it would be a good idea to go there.
No. I mean, if you could, with no repercussions, would you go?
Maybe years and years down the road.
Rachel Min-Young Lee is a senior fellow at the Stimson Center's Korea program. She's been speaking with us about a sprawling new beach resort opening up in North Korea.
We have an update now for you on a story we brought you yesterday about widespread protests in Kenya over police brutality. 16 people have now died in those demonstrations, according to Amnesty International Kenya. Over 400 casualties have been reported, including injured police officers. The protests were marking the first anniversary of an anti-tax demonstration in which 60 people were killed. Those demonstrations merged with a protest focused on police brutality and had calls for President William Ruto to resign. Kenya's interior minister defended the actions of police yesterday, saying that the demonstrators amounted to an attempted coup. Despite the deaths and injuries, he also denied that law enforcement used excessive force.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor here at The World. While I may not be a familiar voice, I've been deeply committed to our work here at The World for years, helping to share the exceptional global journalism you know and love. Since our launch in 1996, The World has weathered many storms, and we remain committed to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. But we are in unprecedented times, and never has the threat to public media been greater than right now because of the efforts to withdraw all federal funding. This puts greater pressure on our newsroom and our journalists. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We're powered by listeners like you. And right now, we need your help. Even if you've never given before, perhaps today is the day. We are in our spring fundraising drive, and a generous donor has offered a 2-to-1 match, tripling your impact between now and June 30th. That means if you donate $25, we receive $75. Your $100 equals to another $300. If you've given in the past, please consider renewing your gift or increasing your monthly contribution, if only by a small amount. Every gift, no matter how small, truly makes a difference. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. UNICEF is raising the alarm about what's happening right now along the border between Sudan and Chad. Hundreds of thousands of children have fled the civil war in Sudan with or without their families and ended up there. Towns in Chad are struggling to provide for all of the refugees. Supplies are limited and many refugee children are said to be malnourished. This is to say nothing of the increasingly grim conditions inside Sudan itself. Alex DeWall is the executive director of the World Peace Foundation at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He is also an expert on Sudan.
They're just facing a desperate shortage of everything that is necessary to sustain life, a shortage of food, water, housing, of protection. They are out of a war zone, but it's not fully safe in those areas. Among many of the children, if they have one parent, that parent is very busy trying to find the necessities and can't really take care of them.
Are there a lot of unaccompanied kids there in the border area? And if so, how are they being cared for?
Just about everywhere, there is some sort of family network. There are very, very few children who are entirely on their own. In many cases, you see aunts, you see grandmothers with huge numbers of children who are just unable to cope with their needs. And that, I think, is why UNICEF is particularly making this call. At the moment, if you look at the United Nations appeals for Sudan, they're only 14% funded. And in the past, you know, more than half of the funds would come from the United States. Well, after USAID has been pared back to the absolute minimum, those funds just aren't coming.
So are those cuts to aid from the U.S. contributing directly to the conditions in Chad?
There were shocking stories when the stop work orders were issued by USAID of voluntary agencies, nurses, being told, don't go to work today. And they had children who were in intensive care, whom they knew would die if they weren't treated that day. So, of course, they went to work. They violated those orders. And very often these organizations had already put the money up front for their operations, and they went out of business because USAID would not pay them for contracts that had already been signed. We're seeing the knock-on devastation of that.
Mm. I want to move across the border now to Sudan itself. Famine conditions were first reported there almost a year ago, and famine has been spreading. Can you tell me more about the conditions there?
The United Nations uses a very precise and rather arcane definition of famine, whereby 20% of the population in a particular area are absolutely destitute, very large numbers of children are malnourished, and people are dying in larger numbers. And in many parts of Sudan, they just don't have the information, they don't have the data. So what we fear is that the situation is even worse than the UN is declaring.
The paramilitary RSF and the Sudanese National Army, the two warring sides here in the Sudanese civil war, are both accused of using aid as a weapon of war. What is their motivation for doing that?
So each side uses food and uses hunger in a slightly different way. So the rapid support forces, the paramilitary insurgencies, they're like a swarm of human locusts devouring everything in their path and devastating the communities through which they rampage. And they've caused an enormous amount of hunger, displacement, deprivation. On its side, the Sudan Army, because it's recognized by the United Nations as the legitimate government, has a sort of veto power over UN agencies, where they can go, what they can do, even though it doesn't actually have any on-the-ground control. And the UN has, in my mind, been extremely timid in standing up to them. So it's basically complied with their orders for not feeding places. And what the government, the Sudan Army, wants to do is so deprive the RSF of basic resources that its command and control fractures, that it doesn't have enough resources to supply its troops, who then turn against it, mutiny or fragment. But of course, what we know from these situations is that the last people to go hungry are the men with guns. Mm-hmm. It's the women, the children, the civilians who starve first.
It is interesting in a very dark way that both warring sides are using food as a weapon of war in slightly different ways, as you said.
And what's particularly tragic here is that if you'd asked me the same question 10 years ago, I would have said forces in Sudan are doing this, but there's international pressure to stop them. We would see the United States and other countries, Europeans, even the Russians and the Chinese saying, you can't really do this. Today, there's a vacuum. There's no action at the UN. You don't have the United States, let alone Russia or China, calling out these horrible war tactics being used by both sides.
I'm wondering if we think back to how this civil war started, when Hamedi, the leader of the RSF, launched a surprise attack on the capital of Khartoum 2 years ago. I'm wondering if you see there any missed opportunities in the very early days of the conflict that could have prevented things from getting as bad as they have. Intervention from foreign powers, whatever.
I think right at the beginning, there was a possibility of concerted intervention led by the United States. That chance was missed. And as the war deepened, it's become more and more complicated. The effort that is required to solve it becomes bigger and bigger. And on the ground, among the Sudanese, the polarization, the bitterness, the divisions have only deepened. It's very easy to start a war. However casually, however quick you think that war may be, it can be very, very difficult to resolve it.
Alex DeWall is a leading expert on Sudan. He's the executive director of the World Peace Foundation at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum has threatened to sue SpaceX. The problem? Falling debris and the environmental contamination that comes from rocket launches at company headquarters in southern Texas. Sheinbaum said in a press conference yesterday that her government is looking into which international laws might be applicable. Conservation groups say the company's more frequent rocket launches will have an impact on sea turtles and coastal birds.
Brazil has signed a $1 billion agreement to ship large-scale farming equipment to Nigeria. Farming in that country largely means people growing food for themselves on their own land. The Brazil deal aims to scale up agriculture in Nigeria as part of a larger plan to boost the economy in the country.
In Greece, wildfires broke out south of Athens today. Local officials issued evacuation orders and shut down parts of roads leading to the city. Greece is seeing its first heat wave of the summer, with local temperatures hitting 104 degrees Fahrenheit. The cause of the fires was not immediately known, but they come on the heels of a major wildfire on the Greek island of Chios. That one took firefighters 4 days to extinguish.
And those are a few things you might have missed.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Religious pilgrimages like the Hajj to Mecca or the Camino de Santiago across Spain were traditionally done on foot or with pack animals. But modern transportation is making some pilgrimages more accessible. Reporter Levi Bridges recently joined one of these more modern pilgrimages, this one to a pair of underground mosques in western Kazakhstan. Along the way, he met a Muslim community that is redefining itself.
This part of Kazakhstan is super remote. Russia is to the north, Iran is south. Both of those countries are hundreds of miles away. At sunrise each morning, a bus leaves the city of Aktau on the Caspian Sea and carts pilgrims out to the mosques. The driver cranks the tunes as we enter a desert interspersed with oil wells. It kind of looks like West Texas. I'm sitting beside men in baseball caps and women wearing long, silky scarves to cover their hair. At the first stop, everyone files toward an outdoor faucet and gathers water to wash their feet. This is Islamic tradition. Then we march through the desert toward a cave carved into a small hill, the first mosque. Inside, we sit on brightly colored carpets. The only light filters in through a hole in the ceiling, basking the face of the imam in a soft glow. When the ritual ends, a friendly Kazakh guy calls out to me. He tells me, walk backwards out of the mosque. I'm confused by this. It's not standard procedure in other mosques I've been to. I stumble backwards out into the daylight, crouching to avoid hitting my head. I ask one guy why they exit the mosque this way. It's just a tradition here, he says. But later, Alim Shahmatov, an Islamic theologian, explains that in this part of the country, it's considered a sign of respect not to turn your back on the mosque. This is a place where many people are reconnecting with traditions like these. Religious life here was stifled for decades under the Soviet Union. Shahmatov says that since the Soviet Union ended in 1991, Islam has had a rebirth with younger Kazakhs. He says in the Soviet days, almost nobody visited Kazakhstan's holy sites. But these days, pilgrimages have become really popular. Shahmatov has visited these underground mosques himself. He says going on these pilgrimages is a dream for Kazakhs like him. Before getting back on the bus, I sipped tea with a Kazakh man named Darhan. He's done this pilgrimage 3 times. He tells me this journey is a healing experience. Trekking out to these mosques can cure health problems, he says, or bring good luck. A couple hours of driving later, the bus pulls into a parking lot, and we all trek down into a deep limestone canyon toward the famous Beket Ata Mosque.
Ooh, it is hot out here. I'm descending down the stairs into the canyon. A woman just walked by speaking Russian to somebody on her telephone, and that is the first time this entire day that I've heard anybody speaking in Russian.
It's a little surprising, for me anyway, because many Kazakhs speak Russian much better than Kazakh. When I'm in other parts of Kazakhstan, most of the street signs and restaurant menus are in Russian. That's not the case at this holy site. Since Moscow invaded Ukraine, people are distancing themselves from Russia's influence, embracing the Kazakh language and national traditions. That doesn't mean Kazakhs isolate themselves, though. On the trail, I meet a couple NBA fans.
And my favorite team is the Los Angeles Lakers. He's my brother. He's Boston Celtics.
He's a Boston Celtics guy. Oh, I see. He's got the Boston shirt. Yes.
The second underground mosque is located inside a rocky outcropping. I head inside and sit on the floor in the darkness with about two dozen other men. It is so hot inside, nobody stays long. Outside the mosque, most people I meet don't list religion as the main reason they came here. A man named Ardak says visiting the mosque is part of being Kazakh. The experience unites people. Alim Shahmatov, the theologian, says Kazakhs usually visit the site because they believe it will bring them good luck. Shahmatov says it's hard to put your finger on exactly what makes visiting these mosques so special. But for him, coming here just makes life feel easier. You get some relief from the grind of adulting. As we hike out of the canyon, lots of pilgrims stop to excitedly point out these wild goats far away in the desert. Seeing goats is a sign of good luck, the pilgrims say. I can't say I've experienced any huge stroke of good luck recently, but gathering with strangers in the underground mosque, just sitting and being present together, it gave me this awesome sense of peace and connectedness that stuck with me. I somehow feel luckier. As the sun starts to set, we all pile in the bus and start the long trek back across the desert. Our modern pilgrimage complete. For The World, Levi Bridges, Western Kazakhstan.
The younger generation's reconnection with Islam is not the only thing that's emerged in Kazakhstan after the religious repression of the Soviet era. Tomorrow we'll hear Levi's reporting about a rise in extremism. That's also happening.
Professional athletes always want to push their limits. This afternoon, Kenyan runner Faith Kipyegon did that to the extreme by attempting to become the first woman ever to run 1 mile in under 4 minutes. The event was part of a Nike project in Paris called Breaking Four. The World's Bianca Hillier joins me now to talk about how it went. Hey, Bianca.
Hey, Carolyn.
So before we get to the results of the race, which I am dying to hear, tell us more about how this race that Nike organized worked.
Yeah, so this wasn't a real race, if you will. This entire event was meticulously designed by Nike to see if Kipyegon could break 4 minutes in the mile. And every little detail was controlled to make that happen. Nike even ordered swatches of 10 track surfaces from around the world to find the very best one. Kipyegon ran in the evening, local time, for cooler temperatures. And there were 13 other elite runners on the track surrounding her. They were both pacing her and keeping her out of the wind. Even her clothes were custom made, so no corners were cut here.
Wow. So this was more of a highly controlled experiment than what you would call a race, as
yeah,
you said.
That's exactly right.
So, okay, you have to tell us now, Bianca, how did it go? Did she do it? Did she break that 4 minute mile mark?
Let me break it down. So a mile is four laps essentially around the track.
Right.
First lap, she was right on pace, looking really comfortable. Second lap, still on pace. Third lap, still on pace. And fourth lap, you know, this is where it gets tough. She's gritting her teeth, pumping her arms, and the fans in the stadium are just loving it as she comes right to the finish line.
The Pacers step away as Faith Kipyegon heads towards history here in Paris.
Carolyn, she ended up crossing the finish line in 4 minutes and 6.42 seconds.
Oh, no.
So not under the ultimate goal of 4 minutes, but it is faster than Kipyegon's own current world record of 4 minutes, 7 seconds. seconds, 0.64. So still just a phenomenal show of athleticism.
All right. So she did not hit that 4-minute mile mark, but does she get a new world record as her consolation prize?
No, not quite. Because of all these special pieces that were in place, that made the racing conditions more ideal than any typical race. So not quite a new world record technically.
All right, so she would have had to shave nearly 8 seconds off of her time to do this, right?
Yes.
I know that's a lot when you're already an athlete performing at the very peak of your ability. Did people actually expect Kip Yegon to succeed in this?
Everyone knew it was going to be a massive challenge. I don't think anyone knew the outcome until she really crossed that finish line. But Faith Kip Yegon is really beloved by fans, by Kenyans, by her fellow athletes. She's been on the world stage now for over a decade, so if anyone was going to do it, it would have been her. And there was a watch party in Kenya in our hometown where they said, you know, this is more than a party. It's a moment of Kenyan pride. So I have no doubt that people are still proud of her.
Yeah, I'm sure. Is anyone talking yet, Kip Yegon or Nike or anyone else, about what might have gone wrong? What might have prevented her from breaking that elusive still 4-minute mile?
It would have been a number of factors. The weather was just about perfect. It could have been a little bit cooler. And then I mentioned, you know, there were at times 13 other runners on the track with her. And to me, it looked a little bit crowded. I mean, maybe there could have been a setup that was slightly tweaked, even though I understand that Nike did put a lot of research into this. But when you're aiming for pure perfection, which they were, the tiniest of things can really add up to make a difference.
I know that Kip Yegon has a busy racing schedule, so she must have had to give up on other opportunities to do this. Did she say anything about her motivation, like why this was important enough for her to do?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because today's event was really about the time, breaking 4 minutes, but it also was about so much more than that. And Kip Yegon said this would really cement her legacy on the track. She's got Olympic gold medals. She's got multiple world records, but she wanted to inspire people, especially women, she says, even if she fell short of her goal. Here's how she put it before the race.
It will give hope to the next generation to believe that we can think big and dream big, believe in ourselves that we can do it.
Believe in ourselves. I'm recalling, Bianca, I think Nike has done something like this before for the marathon, maybe?
Yeah, that's what they did. Back in 2017, there was a project called Breaking 2. That's when Kenyan runner Eliud Kipchoge tried to run a marathon in under 2 hours, which had never been done before. The first attempt, he did not succeed. He missed the mark by 26 seconds, about a second per mile. He tried again, though, 2 years later, and that time he did it. And this is something that is with his legacy. It remains something that people talk about alongside his Olympic medals.
So maybe we'll see Kip Yegon try again for this 4-minute mile?
Yes. She breathlessly said after the race she's going to go for it again. And she thinks today's result proves that it's possible.
The World's Bianca Hillier covers sports for our show and has been sharing all the details from Kenyan runner Faith Kip Yegon's record attempt. Bianca, thank you so much.
Thank you, Carolyn.
It is mango season, and if you're enjoying the fruit here in the U.S., it could have been shipped from India or Mexico or parts of the Caribbean. But mangoes are just as beloved in the communities where they're grown. In Hopkins Village in Belize, there's an annual mango festival. Stoney Ferguson runs Memories Farms there and supplied the mangoes for this year's event. He spoke with me earlier, and I asked him why people love mangoes so much.
Man, it has so many different reflection from what nature has to offer. So, yeah, mango reflects its fauna and flora around it, in my observational view, you know.
I mean, it's the flavor and the texture, too. They're just so smooth and slippery. What, in your opinion, makes a good mango good? And are there better varieties than others?
Well, it all depends on the preference of their flavor, right? Because most people will like sweet mango, some will like sour mango, some will like hairy mango, some will like mango which is hairless. So it all depends on the preference of the individual who's eating mango.
What is your personal preference? What do you like when you eat a mango?
Growing up here in Belize, we have like common mangoes, which is like the local cultural mango, which is one of them is number 11. Which is the most popular mango here in Belize.
Belize mango number 11.
Yeah, number 11. I guess it's so good that they had to put it number one two times, you know. You know, so Besides that, they have the blue mango. It is simply blue on the tree, and when it's ripened, it turns red. That's why it get its name from blue, you know, from the blue shade when it's green.
And the flesh is still orangish yellow, yeah?
It is still orangish yellow, but these ones that I'm talking about has a lot of hair, a lot of fibers, you know. So yeah. These ones, like, it is a natural flash for the teeth. This is what I take from it without using it as some, you know, irritating to the teeth, but I see it as more of a flash for the teeth, cleaning the teeth.
Get the toothpicks and dental floss out.
Yeah. And not only that, I see where we have some mangoes which is not named. And from my observation, I think it has been cross-pollinated and created on its own. Like the mangoes literally creates its own different types. People also modify, create their own mango, which they simply have the name, have their name, you know.
Right, crossbreeding. Stony, I gather that there's a very narrow window for mangoes to be perfectly ripe and in season. So how do you figure out the right time to harvest and sell the fruit? Or, like, if you're exporting, when do you have to harvest so that when they end up in the produce section thousands of miles away, they're ready to be eaten or ripen a bit more?
So the best time, from my experience, give it roughly about 8 days for it to be ready to eat, between cutting to being spoiled.
So do you export your mangoes, and where do they mostly end up?
No, I just do it locally. This is my lifestyle. I simply don't eat processed food. I don't eat any animal or any type of produce that the system produces. So I turn to nature for my consumption. So since that's my lifestyle, I turn it into a business.
Stony, how's this mango season looking?
This mango season is not looking as good as usual.
Why is that?
I guess they would claim climate change, but I have a different narrative to it.
What do you think is happening?
We're just not in the right season, and the months are not... I'm not saying mango season is bad, but we're calling mango season at the wrong time. This is just the beginning of the mango season. It will get more rapidly around August, September, October.
And is that changing the season because of climate change? I mean, you seem to not totally agree with that.
It's not really climate change. It's just the shift in the months. That's what I see. Like, the months are off on the actual time of the mango. And we're looking more for, well, the spring that you will see blossoming and fruits and stuff. Yeah, and we have to basically wait for the right time. And the right time is just about to be here for mangoes to be fully in season. And yes, it will come in season, but it's not there as rapidly as we expect it to be at the moment.
That's Stony Ferguson. He grows mangoes at Memories Farm in Plasencia, Belize. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. If you've recently felt like everyone you know is taking a trip to Japan, you're not entirely wrong. Last year, Japan set an all-time record of nearly 37 million foreign visitors, up more than 47% from the year before. And this summer, get this, Tokyo is set to surpass Paris as the second most popular international destination for travelers from the U.S. The World's transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel has been reporting on the spike in tourism to Japan and joins us for more. So why are so many people, Jeremy, especially from America, flying to Japan?
I've got two words for you, Marco, and they are money and TikTok.
All right, explain that.
I'll start with the money side of things here. In Japan, the currency, the yen, is extremely weak right now, especially in comparison to the dollar. And so that means that everything you get in Tokyo, Kyoto, wherever you travel in Japan, it's all cheaper. And during a recent reporting trip in Tokyo, when I ordered breakfast, I looked at the check, did the quick conversion, and found that I only had spent $3 on a full meal. So even if flying halfway across the world is a little pricey, when you're on the ground there in Japan, your money goes further.
Wow, such a difference from when I remember back in the day. A Coca-Cola is going to cost you so much money in Japan. So that's a financial incentive for going to Japan. How does TikTok play into this?
Well, it actually isn't just TikTok. Go on any social media app and you are flooded with images and videos of travel to Japan. Part of that is a good number of people had trips to the country planned before the coronavirus pandemic. And as you might remember, Marco, Japan completely closed off at that time. So that means you've had 2 years of pent-up demand showing itself over the past couple of years now. And when all of that adds up online, you have this snowball effect and the free advertising for other people to be inspired to make a trip themselves. And then on top of that, as I found in my reporting on the ground, the government itself wants tourists. So they're pushing for and sponsoring more of these videos and photos. And that's prompting more travelers and also more airlines to invest in direct routes to Tokyo.
That's the world's transportation correspondent, Jeremy Siegel. As he just mentioned, Jeremy was recently in Tokyo reporting for The World. And as he found in this report, the influx of tourists is fundamentally changing life and the economy in the world's biggest city.
When I first step into my hotel in Tokyo's Akasaka neighborhood, I'm not greeted by reception or a bellhop. What I see is uncanny. Life-size animatronic hotel workers, dressed in Christmas hats for the holidays, greet me in Japanese and English and guide me through the check-in process.
Welcome to Kanban Hotel.
It's one in a series of non-human encounters I have, including a robot on wheels with a digital cat face that delivers appetizers to my table at a nearby cafe, or the automated ordering and checkout system where I hear a series of beeps as I click through to select my food and make my payment. Now, all of these robots and screens, they aren't just a gimmick. They're a symptom of Japan's unique economic situation. Masamichi Ishikura is a deputy director at the Japan Tourism Agency. He tells me Japan is facing a declining birth rate and an aging population.
Japanese society is, in the long term, is shrinking. So we need to bring in more tourism to revitalize local economies.
The only issue is labor. Even in crowded Tokyo, hotels and restaurants are forced to find non-human alternatives like robots and touchscreens.
Is this your first time in Tokyo? Well, then you gotta check these off your list.
Even still, the country is pushing ahead with enticing more foreign travelers, partnering with content creators on social media platforms like TikTok with videos about experiences you can only get in Japan. And this push for more tourists is working. That includes April and M.K. Tucker, a mother and daughter from the Atlanta area who I saw staring at a map in the heart of Shinjuku, Tokyo's busiest area, which they found a bit intimidating, with hordes of tourists and residents flooding every street corner, crosswalk, and train.
It could be a little difficult, especially with, a lot of people.
Well, you know, everybody's just moving fast, going to where they're going to, and you just got to get in where you fit in, basically. Yeah.
But not every tourist does fit in. According to the tourism agency, there are cultural differences that can be confusing for visitors, like how to use traditional Japanese toilets, or not littering in a country that doesn't have public trash cans and expects people to bring their waste home with them. That tension is on full display near the Meiji Shrine in Tokyo's Harajuku district, where I meet Jay Allen and Noah Asuka. The two head up Unseen Japan, an English language website about Japanese culture and history. In recent years, they've started doing tours for people visiting Japan. Both Noah and Jay tell me that part of their job has become teaching people how to get around Japan without being a nuisance or getting lost, including navigating the massive and complex web of public transportation.
The one thing I see is volume of voice, particularly on public transit. My countrymen, Americans, we tend to be fairly loud. They just don't naturally think about that when they get on, for example, a Japanese train, where people tend to be fairly quiet.
And it's not just trains where the culture clash can be challenging, they tell me. There have been instances of tourists turning visits to shrines, like the one we're walking through, into Instagram photo shoots, even posing for pictures doing pull-ups on gates to sacred grounds. In the Golden Guy District, a series of extremely narrow alleyways filled with some 200 old shanty-style bars and noodle shops, there are signs posted saying photography is prohibited. The shops have just 4 or 5 seats each. Some charge tourists a cover charge. I pop into a whiskey bar and meet Maro-san, who pours me a glass of Japanese whiskey as soul music blasts in the background.
Do you get a lot of tourists coming through here?
Yeah, here about 400% overseas.
400%?
Yeah. Hobo.
His bar has seen a 400% increase in tourists, he tells me, over the past year, before we both get quiet and take in the tune. The next morning at my hotel, I go back to the front desk to check out. This time, I'm not only greeted by the robot receptionists, but a long line of tourists having trouble navigating the automated check-in and check-out system, with the robots calling for assistance when they don't know what to do.
I'm calling the hotel staff.
Amid the lobby's chaos, it's hard to imagine what the future holds, with Japanese officials hoping to double the number of tourists to 60 million by 2030. In that moment, I can't help but long for the human company I found at the Golden Guy Bar with Maro-san. Oh, and the glass of whiskey? That'd be nice, too. For The World, Jeremy Siegel, Tokyo.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Henry Becton, Richard Gingras, Betsy Gardella and Jim Smith, Rima Heider and Camilo Villa, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PR.